Good evening.
It's good to be with you tonight. As a reminder, and as a new note for those who are visiting with us, our theme for this year is a heart to work, borrowed from a verse in Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 6, where the text says that the people had a mind to work. And in the Hebrew we've looked at, that really just means heart. And in most places in the Bible where that Hebrew word is used, it's translated as heart. But in most of our translations, Nehemiah 4, 6 says mind. But the people were being challenged from enemies to stop building the wall, but they built it anyway because they had a mind or a heart to work. I think one of the best examples we have of a heart to work in Scripture is found in Proverbs chapter 31, the poem of the worthy woman, beginning in verse 10 and ending in verse 31, the last 22 verses of the book of Proverbs. So we're going to look at that tonight, but the reason it's one of my favorite passages is not only because of what it teaches, but because of how it's structured. So I hope to look at both elements tonight, the structure being the lesser of the two notes, but definitely the cool note, and we'll go through that tonight. I might use the word cool a lot. I like that word. The book of Proverbs, yeah, cool. The book of Proverbs is, in my mind, split into three sections. It's really two sections with Proverbs 31 as the last. So the first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs contrasts Lady Wisdom with the strange woman or the foreign woman, or also at times called the adulteress or the prostitute. This contrast is very prominent in the first nine chapters, and it personifies wisdom, and it personifies the adulteress, the contrast, and they're both personified as women. I'm not going to tell you why, and I'm not even going to go down that road. But some examples of this contrast, if you look in Proverbs chapter 1, for example, Proverbs chapter 1, beginning of verse 20, says, "Wisdom shouts in the street." Wisdom doesn't shout, but that's the poetry part of Proverbs, one of the many forms in this book, using personification here. "Wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice in the square." So it's assigning a female to this personification. "At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates in the city, she utters her sayings." So this is also showing where wisdom dwells, at least in these couple of verses. Compare that to Proverbs chapter 7, beginning in verse 10. Proverbs 7, verse 10, "And behold, a woman comes to meet him dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner." So the complete opposite, who also dwells in public places, is the harlot. Other contrasts we can find between Lady Wisdom and the strange woman are in Proverbs chapter 3, beginning in verse 13. Proverbs 3:13, "How blessed is the man who finds wisdom, and the man who gains understanding. For her profit is better than the profit of silver, and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her." That verse 15 is also some element we find in the Worthy Woman poem about the excellent wife, her value is far above rubies. So keep that connection in mind when we get to that. But Lady Wisdom here, compared to in Proverbs 2, for example, beginning in verse 16, Proverbs 2:16. Breaking in here, but it says, "To deliver you from the strange woman, from the adulteress who flatters with her words, that leaves the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house sinks down to death, and her tracks lead to the dead. None who go to her return again, nor do they reach the paths of life." So we see this contrast again, what we can get out of Lady Wisdom and her virtues compared to what we will get when we spend time with a strange woman. Metaphorically speaking, or figuratively speaking. The second section of the book of Proverbs is basically the rest of the book, except for chapter 31. They're basically a random collection of wisdom sayings, or proverbs, hence the name of this book. One, for example, is chapter 10, verse 1. "A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother." A lot of the wisdom sayings in chapters 10 through 30 are talking about wisdom. That uses the word wisdom several times. This is one example. And another form of poetry we see in the book of Proverbs, specifically in this verse, is parallelism, where there's a line that's contrasted by the next line. A contrasts B. That's not the formula for every verse in the book, but you see this element a lot in Proverbs. The wise man makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Another example is Proverbs chapter 20 and in verse 1. Not parallelism here, but a different form of poetry. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. And another, briefly, is Proverbs 29, verse 3. A man who loves wisdom makes his father glad, but he who keeps company with harlots wastes his wealth. And the whole book of Proverbs, I mean, specifically chapters 10 through 30, are full of things like this. That's why it's a great book. But the last section, which is really just the chapter 31, is motherly advice about the worthy woman. There is some debate whether or not the worthy woman poem is the words of King Lemuel's mother. Doesn't take away from the meaning of the text or the structure of the poem, but I don't want to say with definitiveness that it is, but really chapter 31 is the first 9 verses, King Lemuel's mother giving her some advice, giving him some advice, and then we see this poem of the worthy woman. So before we look at the text itself, I want to note 2 features of this poem. And when I say poem, we're still talking about God's inspired word. Okay, so let's not lose sight of that. But the beauty and wisdom behind this writing is inspiring in its own way. So there's a form of poetry called acrostic, and an easier way to remember it is alphabetic. In other words, the Hebrew alphabet, which has 22 letters, Aleph through Tau, which is our equivalent of A to Z, is found in this proverb. Verse 10, the Worthy Woman poem specifically, verse 10 of Proverbs 31, which we'll read, starts with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph. Verses 11 through 30 start with the successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet, Bet through Shin. And then the last verse of the proverb, verse 31, starts with the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Tau. There are other examples of this kind of poetry in your Bibles, and one of them is Psalm 119, and another is the first 4 chapters of the book of Lamentations. In fact, if you were to open to Psalm 119 now or scroll through it on your device, most Bibles will throw in little headers that say Aleph, Bet, and it'll go through all the letters in order of the Hebrew alphabet before the verse begins. So that's called acrostic or alphabetic poetry. This is someone's rendering of the letters in succession, A through Z, which is Tau for Hebrew, and the corresponding verses. This is not a random, this is not a happenstance structure. This is a God-designed, purposeful structure, and it's in the inspired word. Another rendition of this I was going to use the pointer on that wall. You can't see that wall. Picking out specific keywords that correspond to the letter, and the verse is in order. So again, A through Z, first verse to last verse, all in order. When Trevor was preaching for us, he did a few lessons on the names of God in the Old Testament. And in the Hebrew, one little symbol, one word, can have a big meaning. And so when we look at it in our English, it's hard to picture the Hebrew, but it's there. In Hebrew language, people know that, and I'm taking their word for it. But in my brief research of the Hebrew text, you can pick out these symbols and lay them next to the verse, and it does go in order, and it's amazing. But what's even more amazing is the next form of poetry that also exists in this proverb. Having 2 forms of poetry in one writing, and especially these 2, is beyond me. But it's called chiastic poetry. This is what it looks like as a formula, if you will. So the first verse in a chiasmus, as we call it, is called, I'm going to call it A. And that's subphrase number 1. And then the next verse builds up, and we're going to call that B, subphrase number two. And then eventually, the chiasmus climaxes at phrase C, the bullseye, which is the main point of the text that does not have a parallel thought. It's its own standalone phrase, the crux, the purpose of the writing, or the main thought, if you will. And then it kind of reverses in order. We go back to B prime, which is a parallel to B. And then we go back to A prime. So now the first verse and the last verse match in thought or in theme in some way. And so we're going to look at the book of the Worthy Woman for this chiastic structure. We're actually going to see two different chiastic structures, or chiasmi. It's a weird plural. In this proverb, to me, this is something that I can open to anything in the Bible and start reading in the English, but when we take a little bit of a dig into God's word, whether it's the meaning of the original language, the structure, the history behind it, we can gain a lot, and I hope we can do that together tonight. So we're going to try to prove and show the two different chiastic structures in this proverb as we actually study the text and look at some of the teachings in it. So buckle up. Chiastic structure number one. So let's go ahead and read the 31st chapter, and then we'll come back and pick out first and last verse, find the parallels. Second and second to last verse, find the parallel. Third and third to last, and eventually we're going to climax at something that wouldn't seem like the climax for this kind of proverb. And so, without giving you a spoiler alert, let's go ahead and read this together. Proverbs chapter 31, beginning in verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. What, O my son? And what, O son of my womb? And what, O son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drink. For they will drink and forget what is decreed, and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his trouble no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and needy. Pause. Not going to talk about all that advice. Some I would want to look at deeper about the whole give strong drink thing to people. But because we have a lot to get through, we're going to just jump right into verse 10. And remember, whether or not these are the words of King Lemuel's mother, a mother telling her son what kind of woman to look for as the wife of a king, isn't necessarily the point, but maybe just chew on that for later thought. But continuing here in verse 10, the beginning of the Worthy Woman poem, as we call it. An excellent wife, who can find? For her worth is far above jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is still night and gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She senses that her gain is good. Her lamp does not go out at night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff and her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, and supplies belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her, her husband also, and he praises her, saying, "Many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain, But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. I'm going to sink that, let that sink in. So, if you wanted to find a parallel between verse 10, the first verse, and the last two verses, let me back up and give you a caveat. A chiasmus does not have to be a verse-for-verse trade. It doesn't have to be one verse to one verse. It can be a phrase or a half verse or three verses compared to a verse, a half verse, three verses, a phrase. So it doesn't have to be a one-for-one trade. So keep that in mind, because some of these we'll see is verse 10 compared to two different verses. So we're going to look through these together. So verse 10, who can find a worthy woman? In the Hebrew, that word for worthy means strong or virtuous. The poem asks the question and leaves the rest to our imagination, as poetry often does. Is the expected answer that no man can find a capable wife, or that capable wives are few and far between, so that a man must search diligently? It could be either. Earlier in this book, one of the Proverbs says, whoever finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor of Yahweh. Proverbs 18, verse 22. So perhaps the idea is that finding a good, finding a capable wife is a difficult task that requires the Lord's help if the man is to succeed. She has a high value. The second part of verse 10 says, for her price is far above rubies. Jewels or rubies can't keep you warm. They can't take care of your family. They have no hands to do hard work. Jewels can't buy many things, and seldom do they buy happiness, even. You can't put a price tag on a good wife. And when Andy Mitchell was here for a gospel meeting last year, he did a lesson on things you can't put a price tag on. And one of those things was his wife, a excellent wife, far above any earthly thing like a ruby. Compare that to the last two verses. Verse 30, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears Yahweh, she shall be praised. The point here is a contrast between superficial beauty, which is vain, and spiritual beauty, which is praiseworthy. When we consider this verse, we need to remember the sharp contrast drawn in the first nine chapters between Lady Wisdom and the strange woman. Think about the beauty of a woman is, and maybe it's a younger man thing, but men have a tendency to be attracted to physical beauty. And I think it's the same for women, but in a different way. But physical beauty is fleeting, but spiritual beauty becomes lovelier day by day. Verse 31 says, give her the fruit of her hands, let her works praise her in the gates. The poet here speaks to the community at large, encouraging them to honor this virtuous woman for her achievements and to praise her in the city gates, which is the center of the city's communal life. There's a high value to have having as a good wife. You can't put a price tag on it. Another parallel we see, the B and B prime, is verses 11 and 12 and verses 28 and 29. Verse 11 says, the heart of her husband trusts in her. He shall have no lack of gain. What is the basis of his trust? For one thing, he can trust his wife will do him good and not harm, as verse 12 teaches us. He can trust her to be industrious and productive, verses 13 through 15 say. He can trust her in business matters, verses 16 through 19 and verse 24. But he also knows that she has a heart for the needy, verse 20. He can trust her to take good care of her family, verses 21 and 27. And his confidence in her makes it possible for him to devote time to community leadership, verse 23. She is wise, verse 26, so he can trust her judgment. She offers wise counsel, but he can trust that she will use kind and gentle words to impart her wisdom. And there is no mention in this verse of sexual fidelity, but it's implied in verse 12 when he says he can trust in his wife. Verse 12 says, she does him good and not harm all the days of her life. Husbands and wives have a great opportunity in that lifelong relationship to do each other good or harm, or both. They can be encouragers or discouragers. They can be frugal or wasteful. They can be faithful or unfaithful. They can bring ruin to the home, or they can bring prosperity. They can be physically or emotionally violent, or they can be nurturing and kind. And the husband of this virtuous wife does not need to worry that his wife will bring him harm in any way. He knows that she will do her best to help rather than hurt. The contrast, B prime, beginning in verse 28, the first part of that verse says, her children rise up and call her blessed. Her children stand in her presence to show respect. They call her blessed. They bless her name. Her beauty and goodness are, the Hebrew word for blessed here is asar, and it includes the connotation of going straight, going onward, advancing forward, and enjoying the blessedness of a straightforward life. The second part of verse 28 says that her husband also praises her. This worthy woman receives honor and praise from those closest to her, her children and her husband. They go to the core of her being. Her beauty and her goodness are all throughout her life, and it's praiseworthy. Verse 29 says, many women do noble things, but you excel them all. These are the words here of her husband, and they're his words of praise that verse 28 says that he gives her. He doesn't compare her to ordinary women, but to excellent women. And even when compared with the best, she exceeds them all. She is much better. So the husband is benefited by the wife, and the husband and the children praise the wife, things that are given to her for her virtuous nature. C and C prime, our next parallels, are verses 13 to 19 in comparing that to verse 27 about the hard work of this wife. Verse 13, she seeks wool and flax and works eagerly with her hands. We're getting a little technical here, but wool is a fiber produced by sheep that is used to make especially warm fabrics, and flax is a plant that produces fiber that is used to make linen fabric. And in the biblical times, wool and linen were the most common fabrics used for clothing, wool for winter and linen for summer. However, people, usually women, had to go through a long series of steps to transform raw wool or flax into cloth. Wool was a costly cloth used primarily by prosperous people, but raw wool must be graded. The wool from some parts of the sheep are worth more than wool from other parts of the sheep. Raw wool has oils and fats and foreign materials like dirt, so a thorough washing is required. Clean wool, once it's clean, must be carded and combed and spun into yarn. That yarn must then be made into fabric or clothing. But when we look at flax, the first step in preparing flax is separating the flax fibers from the rest of the flax plant, which is very, very time consuming, and that allows the non-fibrous materials to rot away. And that flax must be beaten, it must be combed, must be spun into thread on a spindle. That thread must then be woven into fabric, and the fabric must then be made into clothing. With all this time-consuming handiwork involved in the process of making wool or linen clothing, it would be understandable if a woman who has other stuff to do, as we see through the rest of this proverb, does this work without focusing on the tedium of that work. Just making clothing as one responsibility would be hard enough. I don't even know where to begin. And I'm not a woman. I don't live in biblical times. I think I'm smart in some ways, but I can't make clothing. She does this on top of her other stuff. It's incredible. Cool. Verse 14, she is like the merchant ship. She brings her bread from afar. The poet here isn't calling her a sailor. The poet's comparing her to a merchant ship which brings goods from far away in exotic places. Treasures, if you will. This woman is like a merchant ship in that she brings her food from afar. She will not be satisfied with the limitations imposed by the local market, but instead searches far and wide for the best food attainable. Her table will never be boring or monotonous because she works hard to make it attractive and full. Later in this poem, we learn that she's a good businesswoman, So it's possible that the income she received from her enterprise or enterprises, if you will, affords her the ability to get this exotic and nice food. Continuing in verse 15, the first part of 15 says, she rises while it is yet night and gives food to her household. That phrase, the early bird gets the worm, comes to mind. And that simply means that the person who gets started early has a considerable advantage over the person who does not. And she's one of those people. She arises before sunrise to start her preparations for the day. Interestingly, the word translated food in this verse is terep, a word that is usually translated as prey, P-R-E-Y. It's often used of animals that are hunted by lions. This might suggest that this virtuous woman puts meat on the table, an unusual luxury for ordinary people in biblical times. Someone could sacrifice a sheep to put meat on the table, but doing that with any frequency would quickly diminish the herd. But a hunting party could reap a rabbit or a deer for dinner, and these would be called terep, prey. But a woman who puts this kind of meat on the table makes it possible for her family to enjoy meat without diminishing the family's livestock. It is genius. The next part of 15 says she also gives portions for her servant girls. This could either refer to she also gives food to them, but one of the translations of this word refers to work, meaning she gets up early and plans the work for the day for her servant girls so that they would be productive and that they would have the ability to be good stewards of their tasks, and she gets up early to plan for their day. It could mean both of those things. The fact that she has servant girls means that she's a successful businesswoman in, you know, a 21st century term. As a successful businesswoman, she can afford and use and be benefited by servant girls. Verse 16 says, she considers a field and buys it. She purchases a field, but not rashly. She considers how profitable it will be for her family. And her husband can trust her, back to verse 11, that she will not pay too much and that the field she buys will be a good one. In the next part of 16, which says, with the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. So now she's bought a field. Now she's going to use it productively and plant a vineyard with the fruit of her hands, which sounds as if she's using the profits from her other enterprises to afford this prosperity. It's kind of like the phrase egg money. Has anyone heard that phrase before? Those of you who are farmers or know farmers or families for farmers? I don't pretend to know much about farming or how it was in, like, you know, the mid-1900s, but what I understand the phrase egg money to mean is if the woman, for example, was in charge of keeping the hens and all that, she would be able to keep the money she earned from that, and then she could, that was her money to do with what she wanted to do. And if the worthy woman has egg money from all the things she's working on, she's not spending it on a dress, which isn't wrong, okay? But she's maybe collecting it and using it all for her family. She's being selfless in all the monies that she's making. Verse 17, continuing in line C, 17a, it says that she arms her waist with strength, and waist is translated as loins. To gird one's loins is to prepare for a difficult task by wrapping a tunic around your waist tight enough that it won't fall off during your work. And this is just saying that she girds herself with strength. She girds herself mightily. And the next part of that verse says, and she makes her arms strong. We read in verse 15 that she has servants, but that doesn't mean that she's not above manual labor, or she's not above helping in physical ways. She's not a woman of leisure. She lends her strength where it is most needed to ensure that the job gets done and that it gets done well, and she's very productive with her hands and with her arms. 18, she perceives that her merchandise is profitable, which means she has self-confidence that when she makes a purchase, she's familiar or she's confident that it's going to be a good return in her investment. And she's fair when it comes to these exchanges when she's going to sell anything. 18, the latter part of 18 says that her lamp doesn't go out by night. This could mean that she either burns the midnight oil, which means she works late into the night, which, I mean, if she's getting up super early in the morning and she's also working through the night, I don't know how she gets any sleep. So another way to look at it is that she has a light on at night for her family, which means that she runs a well-maintained house, because when you're running a lamp all night, you got to maintain the oil, you got to go work on it. You know, you can't just, it's not a light switch that you can turn on and off. You got to feed it. You got to keep it burning. Maybe, like I said, she just runs a tight house, a well-maintained household, because she's virtuous. And then finally, verse 19 says that she lays her hands to the distaff and her holds her hand to the spindle. Another connection here to cloth making, which, again, is a very tedious, time-consuming task that she does for her family. Compare all of that to verse 27, which says that she looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. That idleness could either mean that she has like a no work, no food policy, or that it means that she doesn't personally indulge in idleness. But either way, she's not one who could be called the sluggard, as we see elsewhere in the Old Testament. So these parallels just point out how hard she has to work and how hard she works for her family. I'll try to speed up a little bit here. The wife gives to the poor an example in verse 20, and she speaks wisdom, a reference in verse 26. These are both things that she's giving to others as part of her virtuous nature. Comparing then verses 21 and 25, the first and second parts of those verses, she has no fear of the weather, of the snow, and she's prepared her family with clothing to get through it. And she also has no fear of the future. She's not afraid of what's to come because she's prepared. F and F prime, she is clothed with dignity in 25a, and her children are clothed in scarlet, verse 21b. She is prepared and she's given her family ample resources to handle any situation. But the true clothing, the true covering of her nature is beauty and dignity. Our last parallel is the coverings that she makes for her bed, that she's also wearing linen, and that she sells garments and sashes. So she is very handy in the cloth making. We've looked at it a couple times. The only verse we haven't talked about, which has nothing to do, well, has much less to do with the wife herself, is verse 23, public respect for her husband. Let's read verse 23 again. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. We talked about the gates and how it's really the center of communal life. You have to come into the city through the gates, and you have to exit the city through the gates. At the gates, prophets are prophesying. People are selling things. City elders are administering justice at the city gates, day and night. This is the center of the city. And when he sits among the elders, he is not among the peasants. He's in a respected crowd, respected audience. But he's one of those men who has the respect, public respect, because of her. Because of the capableness and the trustworthiness and the faithfulness, the virtuous nature of his wife. So when we look at all those verses and we talk about all the virtues that she has, how come the climax isn't about her? It is about her. Underlying the respect for her husband, it's because of her. I couldn't make that up if I wanted to, on top of the acrostic poetry that we already looked at. I mean, I don't even know if the greatest poet in the world could make up something like this. But it's here for us, and it's also the inspired word of God. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. Quickly, another structure is a shorter one. But jumping ahead, it ends up verse 23 again. Verses 20 and then 26 and 27 parallel. The first part of 21 and the latter part of 25, they parallel, and so on. And it climaxes again at verse 23. So the fact that there are two chiasmi in this proverb is also not random. So to me, that's encouraging. Okay, so some observations as we close here. Just about the text itself, okay? So the wife serves her husband. The text does see the wife in terms of what she can do for her husband or the family, but that's understandable given that it's a patriarchal age or setting. If this is the advice of King Lemuel's mother to her son, telling him what he should look for in a wife, she has set forth appropriately high standards for the wife of a king. Thirdly, the text portrays an ideal woman, and it does have the potential for creating unrealistic expectations on the part of men who might hold their wife to a high standard and criticize her for failing, or for women saying, I need to attain to this, and being insecure about that. So we need to be sensitive about that and not say, you need to be this Proverbs 31 woman, or as the woman saying, oh, I'm not good enough. We need to be sensitive when we use this passage when it comes to our expectations. Remember that Proverbs are supposed to be used as general wisdom, okay? Fourthly, the worthy woman is one who works hard and fears God. That's the simply put version. You don't have to be a cloth maker to be a worthy woman like this. This isn't that you have to mirror it exactly. A worthy woman is one who simply works hard, one who fears God, one who supports her husband, who supports her family, someone who would fit our theme. And our fifth observation, the final, before we have a conclusion of sorts, is that she's not limited to domesticity, okay? She's one who's out in public. She's one who's doing things in the community, in business exchanges. So it takes more of a non-traditional approach in explaining the virtuous nature of this woman. So finally, in conclusion, and thanks for hanging in there, it's a lot of text to go through and not wanting to miss anything. You don't have to be a woman to find application to this. There are qualities that we can all strive for to be worthy in God's eyes. We all need to work hard to serve our families physically, spiritually, universally. We should all strive to be those types of people. Secondly, you don't have to be of royal importance to aspire to find such a spouse as this woman. This is written to King Lemuel, and if it's, you know, again, if it's the advice of his mother, that's one thing, but this isn't the formula for, okay, if you're royalty, you have to have this kind of wife. It's just, again, a general finding someone who fears God and who works hard. And finally, God wants all of us to work hard in all of our roles as wives, yes, as husbands, as servants, as laborers in God's vineyard. We're all called to work hard for God and to aspire to have these virtues. So in not so much of a nutshell, that's the lesson. There's a lot of different forms of poetry, different things you can look at in the Old Testament for your encouragement. If you were just to read through this, you would get a lot out of it. But looking at maybe at a deeper level, looking at the structure of it, is another beautiful thing all in itself. So I hope that's helpful to you and for you. This lesson wasn't really focused on getting your life right with God. But if you're not living even close to a virtuous life, that doesn't really get you closer to God. We have to strive to attain to that perfection that God calls us for. We're not ever going to reach the perfect calling that God wants us. We're not going to become the virtuous woman perfectly in every single way. But God calls us to try. And we need help in doing that sometimes. So if you're swamped in sin, if you haven't even started your relationship with God, we need to work together to do that. We want to see each other in heaven, and we need to help each other along the way to get there. So if there's any burning desires in your hearts, if anything is really hitting you hard, tonight, or if you need encouragement in any specific way, we'd invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.